We approach the end of the light appreciation transmission session, but I hope we can continue to appreciate the light endlessly. It might feel in this kind of session where we're just hearing these stories of the Zen ancestors, it's not so practical. It's not like, it's far from, okay, here's some meditation instructions you can follow, these steps, day after day we'll go through different steps and meditations you can follow. It seems quite different. And sometimes we do that, and that can be helpful too. But this seems to be our family style, is exploring these teachings that may be meditation and life practice instructions, coming in a unique form. So we're now looking at ancestor union, cloudy cliff. Practiced with Baijan for 20 years and then went to Yaoshan. So I think I said maybe this morning, well, I don't know if Baijan and Yaoshan ever met or not, but it looks like they did. There are a few conversations with them. And then we've heard a few dialogues of Baijan and Yunyan. But here's another about Yunyan and Baijan. Remember, Baijan is also the one who says, a day without work is a day without food. And he wouldn't eat when they took away his tools, his work tools. But this is a little bit about how he thinks about his work practice, his farming practice. Yunyan asked Baijan, "Every day there's hard work. Who do you do it all for?" And Baijan said, "There is someone who requires it." And Yunyan said, "Why not have him do it himself?" And Baijan says, "He has no tools." Yunyan says, "Every day there's hard work. Who do you do it all for? Do you do it for yourself, for the community that you're practicing with, or for me, or who? For all beings?" Baijan says, "There is someone." We've heard about this someone before, right? There's someone who requires it, requires me to do this hard work. So, well, why not have him do it himself? It's that someone has no tools. That one that doesn't work and has never actually done anything, but yet requires him and us to work hard. He has no tools, but he requires us to get up every morning and live our life and do our work. He actually requires it. He demands it. Work for me. Because if you don't, that will be like darkness and gloom. And Yunyan is the disciple of Yaoshan in the end, and he's the teacher of Dongshan, which next Denkoei Sesshin will probably have to start with the story of Dongshan, who's, we really might say, the founder of what we call Soto Zen. Tozan Ryokai is Dongshan in Japanese. So he's kind of like our founding ancestor, even though all these ancestors are. But Dongshan's very, very important Zen ancestor to us. And his teacher was Yunyan, who we've been talking about. Yunyan, who awoke when he heard about when he heard his teacher appreciate his former teacher's teaching. Right? When he heard Yaoshan say, "Now I've met Baijiang through you. Why didn't you say so before? Why didn't you tell me about Baijiang before?" So there seems to be this is really about light, but there's this sub-theme that I didn't really notice until we started getting into all this. Obviously it's about teachers and students in this record of transmitting the light, because it's about this lineage being passed along. But did all of these stories, at least the last few, have had, it's more than just one teacher and student. There's several people working together here in quite dynamic ways, particularly Yunyan's story and Yaoshan's story. And Dongshan and Yunyan had something similar too. Yunyan, our present ancestor that we're looking at, just so if you know some of these stories, he's also the one who, he's a Dharma brother of Dao Wu, and one of these records actually said also a biological blood brother. There, I had never heard that one before. Yunyan and Dao Wu, there's lots of dialogues, them talking, that they're actually brothers of the same family, and they both became monks and were very close Dharma companions also. So we have the story of Yunyan sweeping the ground in the Book of Serenity. You maybe know that one. Yunyan sweeping the ground, and Dao Wu says, "Too busy." And Yunyan says, "There's one who's not busy. You should know there's one who's not busy." And Dao Wu said that, "Well, then there's two moons. There's two going on here. There's the one who's busy and the one who's not busy." And Yunyan holds up the broom and says, "Which moon is this?" And then we have the same too. Yuan Yan and Dao Wu talking about the Bodhisattva of great compassion. Right? Yuan Yan asks, what does Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva of great compassion, do with so many hands and eyes, her thousand hands and eyes? And Dao Wu says it's like reaching back for a pillow at night. These are wonderful stories, I think. The way that the great compassion works in this groping in the dark kind of way, like, oh, the pillow, just without any conscious effort or discrimination. That's how this great compassion works. And Yunyan is also appears in this a lot of stories with Dongshan. And there's that one of when Dongshan's finally leaving Yunyan, and he says, after your death, how can I portray your image? Or if people ask me, what's your truth, what should I say? And Yunyan said, just this is it. And they continue, you know, we'll save these stories for when we get into Dongshan. But shortly after that conversation, Dongshan sees his reflection in a stream and awakens to the way. But later, Yunyan is... I bring up these stories now because, again, it's about this thing of like multiple teachers going on. Yunyan is doing these memorial ceremonies like we do here each month, making offerings to the image of Dongshan. A photograph of Dongshan on the altar, and offering, probably they were offering sweet water, rice and tea. At least by the Song Dynasty, that's what they were offering in the way that we do. It's very, very ancient. Offering to deceased teachers. And this is the story that I mentioned earlier, but so I didn't know where it was from. Here it is. As Dongshan was conducting this memorial ceremony for Yuan Yan, his teacher, a monk asked, what instruction did you receive at your late teacher's place? And Dongshan said, although I was there, I didn't receive his instruction. The monk said, then why conduct a service for him? Dongshan said, even so, how dare I turn my back on him? And the monk said, well, you rose to prominence at Nanchuan's. Then why do you instead conduct a service for Yun Yan? So I guess that Dongshan later practiced with Nanchuan, but his first teacher was Yun Yan. So why don't you do a service for your main later teacher, Nanchuan, instead? And Dongshan said about Yun Yan, I do not esteem my late teacher's virtues or his Buddhist teaching or his forms. I only value the fact that he didn't explain everything for me. That's why he honors him the most. The monk said, you succeeded to the late teacher. you know, you were Yun Yan's disciple, then do you agree with him or not? This is a question that might sometimes arise. This is an issue. Does one, I mean, if you succeed to your teacher, do you have to agree with them? Dzogchen said, I half agree, half don't agree. The monk said, why don't you completely agree? How can you be devoted to your teacher if you don't completely agree? And Dzogchen said, if I completely agreed, then I would be unfaithful to my late teacher. This is how the transmission of light continues and doesn't die out. Otherwise, it would never evolve and change. It would never have come all the way over here to Santa Cruz. In America, Suzuki Roshi's teacher said, I don't want you to go to America. Please, I think this would be really good. There's all these beings that could benefit over there. No. No. And he came. Anyway. And here we are. Now, Wan Song, the commentator, and this is case 49 of the Book of Serenity. Dzogchen presenting offerings before the image, it's called. And there's, you know, the story itself. You can read on your own. But the commentator says, I say Yun Yan was with Baijiang for 20 years, yet succeeded to Yaoshan. Dzogchen rose to prominence at Nanchuan's, yet succeeded to Yun Yan. Different sprouts of the same kind become luxuriant, making the spiritual roots dense and firm. With Furong, this is Furong Daokai, Fuyo Dokai, the school was revived with Qiantong. Its embellishment was finally complete. So different sprouts of the same kind become luxuriant, or like, I'm picturing like moss, the way moss grows. It's like there's just these little tiny sprouts, but they just they start spreading into this whole soft pad of bright green. One patch, making spiritual roots dense and firm. The roots are woven together like this. So there's some praise for the way that all these people are helping each other. It's not like this nice, neat, singular lineage. It's that influence is coming from all different directions. And I think that's how our lives work, isn't it? So now we're back to the story of Yun Yan. At this point, although Yun Yan repeated Baijiang's words when the monks were leaving the hall, now, some people weren't here this morning, so let me just briefly tell you this story at hand. This was Yun Yan studied with Baijiang for 20 years, and then afterwards he studied with Yaoshan, who he succeeded to. And Yaoshan was constantly asking him, what did your teacher Baijiang teach? So, in this case, He says, what dharma does Bhajang teach? And Yunyan said, once he entered the hall to speak and all the monks were standing in rows, standing for the dharma talk, and he suddenly took out his staff and swung it around and scattered them all. The rows all broke up into chaos and people running. And then he called out, oh monks! And when they turned around, Bhajang said, what is it? And so Yaoshan, who asked him, what does your teacher teach, says now, why didn't you say that before? Today, thanks to you, I've been able to meet Brother Bhajang. And with those words, Yunyan was greatly awakened. He wasn't awakened when he told the story about his teacher, but when he told the story to his current teacher about his past teacher, and his current teacher was totally appreciated that story. Oh, now I see it. Like, even though the one telling it didn't even see it, but when he saw it, he woke up. The one who told the story only woke up when, not by telling the story, but by the other's appreciation of the story he just told. How we affect each other and inconceivable ways. Mystical communion of meeting. So we're up to in the commentary here to where Yunyan repeated Bhajang's words when the monks were leaving the hall. What is it? Yunyan, who's telling the story, still clung to what someone had said and did not arrive at his own realization. However, by mentioning it, he immediately mentioned what is the most authentic Zen way by far. He's like, well, you know, he did this one of those Zen things of when people were startled and didn't know what was happening, he asked, what is it? So Keizan saying that mentioning that story, he immediately mentioned what is the most authentic Zen way by far. It's by far the most authentic way. What is it? Therefore, Yaoshan said, why didn't you say that earlier? Thanks to you today, I've been able to meet Brother Bhajang. The meaning of the monks standing in rows and being suddenly scattered by the staff is that they were liberated and free. So, us sitting in neat rows along the borders of the Zendo will soon be scattered. Liberated from this sesshin, and who knows what will happen next. Again, they were standing there in rows waiting for the usual Dharma talk, and though they were, of course, free from the start, they didn't appreciate it. They were just waiting for another Dharma talk. But in this moment of not knowing what was happening, at such a time, what? What is it? He did not have to trouble himself to test them again, but if he had stopped there, it seems that they would not have got it in a million eons. So he's saying, by shaking the staff and scattering them. Like, the work was already done at that point. Just to scatter these neat rows of waiting people into the chaos of the unknown. He didn't have to trouble himself to test them again, but if he had stopped there, it seems that they would not have got it in a million eons. It seems that. I mean, they maybe did get it right then, but to finish his job. Consequently, in order to startle them, he shouted, "O monks," in a loud voice. "If you strike a blow in the south, there's movement in the north." They turned their heads unconsciously. Is this not the immutable knowledge of all Buddhas? And then they wondered, yeah, what is it actually? He just asked us, well, what is it? So, and now he's waiting for a response. What actually is it? Is this not the fundamental affliction of ignorance? Since awakening is ultimately unconnected with thought, they nodded in this way. They turned their heads. Since awakening is ultimately unconnected with thought, they could just... But if they try to figure out and explain what it is, thought will be a will obscure. It won't destroy the light, because the light can't be destroyed. The light doesn't get born when we're born, doesn't cease when we die. It's not more in Buddhas or less in sentient beings, but thought obscures it. Like the clouds obscuring the sun. Awakening is ultimately unconnected with thought. But since thought doesn't stop it, thought isn't some inherent problem either. It's just that enlightenment's unconnected with thought. Thought can be going on, but that's not the enlightenment. Like the way that the earth, trees, walls, tiles, and pebbles are constantly teaching the Dharma and embellishing Buddha's awakening that resonates back to them and helps all beings in infinite kinds of ways. All this, however, does not appear within perception of the thinking mind. For that reason, since awakening is ultimately unconnected with thought, they nodded in this way, or they turned their heads. For that reason, he asked, what is it? Unfortunately, not a single person in Baijiang's community understood. But though no one here answered, far away, Yao Shan said, thanks to you, I've been able to meet Brother Baijiang. So, Kazan says, unfortunately, not a single person in Baijiang's community understood. But, maybe not so bad. Is understanding the issue? The fortunate attainment of understanding? They got to be scattered from their rows and stand in awe of what it is. Is it what? And I don't know. So if it's so unfortunate that they didn't understand that. When one of the ancients expressed a phrase from this realm, others said that they had met. This is like the same wind blowing for 1,000 miles, like not being separated by so much as a hair. So it's not a matter of time and space, because Baijiang had said that in another place at a different time, and yet Yao Shan was able to meet him through the words of his student Yun Yan. Yun Yan studied with Baijiang at first, and later was able to climb Mount Yao Shan. In the end, there was no gap between master and disciple, and he reached the great Dharma. If you awaken to this realm, you will not only stop doubting your eternal self, you will be able to see through all the Buddhas of the three times, successive generations of ancestors, and thoroughly ordinary patro monks with one glance. You will cut through them with a single blow, meet Yao Shan and Baijiang at once, and directly see eye to eye with Yun Yan and Dao Wu. All those folks. You will not only stop doubting your eternal self. So I think maybe we talked about that here one point about the Mahaparinirvana Sutra says the qualities of nirvana and Buddha nature. This is one of the main Buddha nature sutras, the Mahayana Mahaparinirvana Sutra, has this the characteristics of this nature are jo raku ga jo. So jo raku ga jo, eternal blissful self and pure, as opposed to the characteristics of phenomena in the earlier teachings, which are impermanent, not permanent, which are not self, as opposed to self, which are impure. All conditioned things are defiled by our dualistic thinking, as opposed to pure and suffering, as opposed to bliss. So that line right from the Enmejuku Kanon-ryo is the four qualities of nirvana or Buddha nature, as presented in the Mahaparinirvana Sutra. Eternal, blissful, self, pure. So here's Jo Raku Gajo. So it's the opposites, right, from the characteristics of all conditioned phenomena that the Buddha taught in the early sutras. So this is very radical teaching. Yeah.
What does self mean there?
Self. And they even use the in this Parinirvana Sutra, they even use the word Atman, and the Chinese character that means like a personal self. Here they have it's capital S, but That's why it's a particularly controversial as a Buddhist teaching. You know, sometimes they kind of skirt around it and say, well, you know, there's your true nature, or the storehouse consciousness is kind of like a self, but it's not really a self. Here there's outright in the sutra, and it's a important and widely studied and respected Indian Buddhist sutra, the Mahaparinirvana. Not the Pali Canon one, but the Mahayana version, which is a huge volume. Self. The Buddha says, I teach self. And even in the sutra, I think the listeners are all totally startled. Like, what are you talking about? Yes.
I don't see a problem with differentiating big S self as unconstrained self and a personal self, which is a constrained self. I don't see a problem with that.
Yeah. Neither did Buddha.
When we get into the Yogacara school, we speak of one mind. And that one mind is not constrained, or, to use older words, defiled. But it is capable of being constrained in the conventional world. And it comes up with all these partial views, none of which are necessary or sufficient to describe yourself. So ultimately you can talk about that, but it's not differentiable. I can't distinguish my true self from your true self. At this place, it's just self.
Yeah. We could say in the from this Mahayana perspective that it's really like the illusion of impurity, suffering, impermanence, and even no self are the characteristics of the. I think that the issue with self and no self is the hardest hitting one there. So we could say, oh, well, there's a permanent nature. If we're talking about emptiness, for example, it doesn't come and go. The emptiness of each thing doesn't come to be. Emptiness is always thus permanent, and that's pure, when pure from the obscurations of dualistic thought, and it's blissful. Actually, even in the early teachings, Buddha said nirvana is bliss. So we're calling that a self now. The Buddha is saying that's like our true self. Yes.
Well, how do these things all end up in the same place?
Yeah.
As you're talking right now, I'm just recalling the line we chanted from the Genjo Koan this morning, and this seems like the same thing about the wind and, you know, how can you say that fan?
The nature of wind is permanent, right?
Yeah. I mean, could you say that,
those
lines?
You know, there it is, particularly the issue of permanence. The nature of wind.
Going, and then there's like the, I forget who it is in the end, they're calling the foil, the student. But how can that be? And
yeah.
He just fans himself.
Although you understand that the nature of wind is permanent, you don't understand the meaning of its reaching everywhere. So, but the issue being that the nature of wind is permanent. Wind is not permanent, but the nature of wind is permanent.
Isn't that the same thing? Or am I just...
Yeah, I think, yeah, the nature of everything, because the nature of things is their emptiness, and that it doesn't come and go. Now, I could just... It's not that late. Relatively. The other day, last week, I was up at Green Gulch, and I hesitate to bring this up because it was like this unresolved debate. I had a debate with my teacher. It's kind of public debate. it was like this seminar, we were studying something, and I forget how it came up. We were studying Asanga, right? The this Yogacara text, but somehow it came up that I said, well, that's starting to sound like this is kind of was a kind of philosophical debate, so it may not be that juicy after all, right? But it was juicy for me, and so I said something like, "This sounds like you're saying emptiness is conditioned." Did you?
I said the same thing to him.
Oh.
Really?
And like, because we usually hear the ultimate truth, and emptiness is like the unconditioned. And he's saying, yeah, do you have a problem with emptiness being conditioned? It's not constructed. We have this Sanskrit term, samskrita, and that means like put together, and then asamskrita means unconstructed, and it's often translated as unconditioned. And he was making that distinction and saying, emptiness isn't constructed, but it's conditioned. In other words, the way it's conditioned, according to him, was that it depends on, as at least this is the way I understand it, it depends on the thing that is empty. Like, there's not like a like an emptiness, like a kind of abstract emptiness floating in space. It's like there's this stick, and then the emptiness of the stick. And it's funny to even speak about emptiness as a thing, but this is kind of saying it's a there's the, you know, it's the absence of actual stickness in the stick is what emptiness is, right? It's that there's not really a stick here, but then we kind of make that into a positive statement and call it, it's the emptiness of the stick. And so the emptiness is dependent on the stick. The emptiness of the stick is dependent on the stick, he's saying. Yeah.
Yeah, I tend to see this in current mathematical terms. You know, there's the bare possibility, there's the probability, and then there's the actuality. And the bare possibility is unconstrained. The field of infinite field of all possibilities is unconstrained. But it is constrainable. It's constrainable through, say, karma by in Kalaya and creating probabilities of possibilities. And then conditions make an actuality out of the probability. But the fundament is the infinite field of all possibilities. And that is emptiness. And emptiness expresses itself, and what is expressed implies emptiness.
Sometimes we say emptiness expresses itself, and it depends how, I think there's different views, because I also remember this other, maybe related discussion from some time ago, but and this was actually another seminar with Tigan Layton, right, who's a wonderful translator and teacher and scholar, I would say. And he was saying, well, what we say, like everything comes from emptiness, right? And again, Tenzin Roshi said, don't be careful with that. Don't say it like that. Because emptiness is not some like source. And it, again, I said, depends on what we're talking about. Like from a kind of Taoist perspective or something, it's like, and sometimes in Zen we hear things like that, but from the maybe more kind of classic Madhyamaka presentation, it's just emptiness is just this absence of essence in things. So it's like, it's hard to say that the things come from the lack of essence of them, right? I think that's what he was emphasizing.
If we're talking about light.
Light.
Light is imperceptible, except when it is constrained by an instrument, say our vision faculty, or bouncing off of something else.
Yeah.
You go into space, You don't see light.
Right.
It is the condition of all possibilities that anything can appear, but it only appears because of a constraint that's placed on it. It's not to say that stars pop out of emptiness. There is a constraint that appears as a star. The star does not emptiness, but constrained emptiness makes it a star.
Maybe one way I would go with that is that because we have been talking in that kind of metaphor and image around light here, this light that we're looking at, but my first response would be like, then the light that I've been speaking of is not merely emptiness. That's why it's a little different.
It's not
merely emptiness. Mm-hmm. This light.
I'm saying that.
Yeah. It's the inseparability of emptiness and clear awareness. So if you have this empty, clear awareness mind, then that can be constrained, and can be revealed through instruments and so on.
I didn't say that light was emptiness. I said light is a metaphor for emptiness in physics. When you can't actually see it in and of itself, it's only inferred through the constraint that's placed on it.
Yeah, I think we can say that about emptiness, that like the emptiness of the stick can't be seen by our perception,
right.
But it can be inferred both through reasoning and this, there's the appearance of a stick, and the stick's actually empty.
Yes. Our faculties select things. Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't say that there's like a kind of ethereal kind of emptiness that the stick kind of like morphs out of.
No.
Yeah. Right. So some, you know, spiritual traditions do say that. I think, I don't know Taoism so much, but it might be a little bit like there's this Tao, universal Tao, that's like the source of everything, and that the phenomenal world kind of like arises out of the Tao. But maybe in Buddhism we would say, we could go with that if we say that the Tao is the mind. We could say everything, the phenomenal world actually arises from the mind, particularly in the Yogacara perspective. But again, there it is. The mind is not merely emptiness. It is emptiness, but its mind is the union of clear awareness and emptiness. It's not just a negation. Emptiness, strictly speaking, from like a kind of Madhyamaka point of view, emptiness is just a negation. But then there's this twist in this last week's conversation about, well, is emptiness conditioned? You heard something like this?
Yeah, I think I asked him if emptiness was conditioned and if awakening is conditioned. Because he had mentioned this thing, I don't know if he talks about it, but there's this thing of like karmic existence, and then there's like where the Buddhas come from.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, are they separate? Like trying, you know, that was the part that I didn't understand. Have you heard him talk about like the bodhisattva, like transmission to this world?
Like kano doko. Be one way of talking about it.
Yeah, less person affinity, but other.
Well, like the wisdom seed in Alaya,
right.
That one,
yeah.
That Asanga talks about. Right? Like there's pure, undefiled, you know, undistorted, unobscured wisdom mind, and if we're talking in the Yogacara perspective where there's seeds, it's like, it's just a metaphor, right? But there's like this wisdom seed that's, yeah, comes from the Buddhas. And if it weren't for that, because otherwise Alaya, our storehouse consciousness, is completely just infused with dualistic thought. There's nothing but just delusion in our mind. But the seed, we could also call, I mean, maybe Asanga doesn't go there, but I say Buddha nature. And it's already here. this is where language gets tricky. Not exactly in Alaya, but permeating Alaya, the storehouse consciousness of dualistic thought. And it's kind of like because of that potential that the storehouse of delusion can completely dissolve. These are like the old Indian stories, right? This is the classic view. So now in this Indian view, do they ever say things like the immutable knowledge of all Buddhas is itself the fundamental affliction of ignorance, and vice versa? Yes.
Or did he start swinging your stick and saying, "What is it?"
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, that's the Zen contribution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This whole method of trying to understand the world was just.
Because a startled moment of what is it, and really like not knowing for even a moment, is we're free from dualistic obscuration. And do we understand that? Or, again, do we appreciate?
My guess is that these students were all entrained on Vajra. They're all entrained on him, unwillingly expecting to be formed by this man. And he basically said, "That's bullshit. It's all bullshit. You're not going to be trained by me." And nobody got that. They ran off and, the thing is broken. But what he's doing is creating an intellectual moment. He was creating an opportunity for absolute presence that had no prior form, no expectation, no trajectory. That's what he did. And nobody got it, according to the story.
Could be the aspect that he was trying to say, don't look in any particular place. Don't look here. You have. Koji, did you?
No.
Have something?
I did.
Oh.
that geese has flown away.
Where have they flown?
Away.
Oh, you're too far away to tweak. I know, Lisa. Yes.
I just had like a clarified question between the relationship between emptiness, the storehouse consciousness, and Buddha nature.
Yeah, maybe a big topic. But have you heard those a little bit about those terms? And
I was just reading something yesterday how some Tibetan Lama was telling this parapsychologist that trying to teach him a little bit about Tibetan Buddhism, that there's the God, the good, God good, and there's a God bad, the Yama and Manyamaka. Yama is the bad one and Manyamaka is the good one. I think I might have a problem. Or Yamataka maybe. I'm mixing up that. But anyway, there's a God good and a God evil. The God good has like 10 arms. And the one student asked him, why does he have 10 arms? And he's like, that's because it's not about the arms, it's about the other. It's not about the other arms. That there, it's not about the thing, it's about the nothing, the lack of the thing. There's like a no thing. That the thing helps to point you towards.
I don't know about the arm. I'm not getting really the arm image in this case. But the thing in the relationship of the thing and the no thing is at work through all these stories too, and the question about the storehouse consciousness that's they said to be give rise to all our experiences. And also registers all our experiences in every moment, and accounts for having an experience like a habit that we did something yesterday and we have a habitual response, it accounts for things like that, that if you don't have this storehouse, it's hard to talk about how those things could happen. But it's all, and it's not something, it's just it's an image of a storehouse, but it's the whole collection of all our past dualistic activity of body, speech, and mind, and it gives rise to our experience. And then Buddha nature, in some traditions, particularly this is called the Lankavatara Sutra, it's pretty much equates, this is maybe too big to get into, right? But this is going to be a topic of study for next year, the Lankavatara Sutra. But it looks like it kind of equates the storehouse consciousness with Buddha nature, which is very weird, right? Because Buddha nature is like pure, undefiled, and the storehouse consciousness isn't. But I think it's emphasizing Buddha nature as this like undeveloped potential, as this, I mean, literally it's Tathagata Garbha in this case. It's the storehouse of an undeveloped Tathagata, which is like a Buddha. So, and emptiness would be the when all of that, when the storehouse consciousness is completely realized to be vast emptiness, then that's like when Tathagata Garbha has come to, or Buddha nature has come to fruition. So those three do have a very interesting relationship, the three of them. You could almost say, or maybe another way to talk about it is like, this is, you know, maybe less strange than this Lankavatara Sutra. It's like, there's the storehouse consciousness of dualistic obscurations, and it's like traveling alongside, and it's just an image, they're completely woven, but there's another stream of Buddha nature. It's like these pure seeds in the alaya, kind of alongside all the, by pure and impure we just mean like dualistically obscured, the dualistically obscured and the not and the unobscured seeds, which are called Buddha nature, going side by side, and the obscurations when they're realized to be empty, eventually completely drop away, and there's just the final fruition of this Buddha nature as Buddha. Again, these things sound so different, right, from these Zen stories.
It sounds like it's kind of like the tenth way of talking about what's going on technically to the
I think so. Yep.
Because there's like, okay, so it sounds to me like you're saying about the getting in a rut. You know, so you're in the rut and you don't know how to get out. Maybe you don't even know that you can get out. Then there's something that comes up. Oh, there's a possibility to come out. That's kind of like emptiness. So there's a chance that there, or maybe that's the dualistic part. So there's a rut and there's also a not rut. And it's a possibility to bridge that camp. There's a possibility to bridge that camp.
There's always total possibility.
And that's where people, they like talk about faith in the Christian tradition and stuff like that. There's a chance to jump.
And you could say the moment of jumping off the top of a 100-foot pole or whatever, out of the rut, you could say, well, how does that jumping happen? It seems like it's just spontaneous. One way of talking about that would be like, that's Buddha nature actually is what jumps. Or it's those wisdom seeds that have like, that have been sent from outer space by the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, sometimes how it sounds. These images are, you know, we have to be careful because they're all just like metaphorical ways of talking that if we think that it's, any of it's literal, then we get in trouble.
I was going to say one last thing was that, and that's the kind of the beauty of the teacher, is he can show how to jump. And the stories kind of can portray how the teacher showed how to do it. So it can be kind of an instruction. Mm-hmm. But you gotta
Yeah, and they're not even so much teaching how to jump. They're just stories about jumping, mm-hmm. And just doing the jumping. So they more like inspire, because we have to all jump in our own way. So they're like inspiration for jumping. Like, can we really jump out of this rut? And then we hear like, through you, now. Thanks to that, I now understand Bhajan, and somebody like jumps out of the rut, or they're like yanked out of the rut by Buddha nature. And so, wow, yes.
Well, earlier you were kind of making almost an apology, like, well, you know, it would seem like maybe these stories aren't quite so practical because it's not like a meditation instruction,
mm-hmm.
but. I mean, I just get tremendous encouragement from these stories because of the diversity of all the different ways that everybody jumps. You know, it makes me feel like, well, there's so many different options and all these different kinds of people, you know. I mean, if you really, really look at all the personalities of all these people and like some of the early Indian ancestors, I mean, there was, you know, rich and poor and smart and dumb and, you know, everybody is in there. I mean, not women, but we're doing not that. You know? And the women were doing it, they didn't get in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Few of them did.
Yeah, few of them did. Yeah, like that collection I was telling you about that was so encouraging. But I don't, in a way, I mean, I care, but I also don't care because I see myself there. It's not so much about gender for me, it's not my point. But that just, you know, certain lines from some of them will completely, like that one I was telling you, you know, it doesn't come walking through the gate, it comes forth from your own breast. Yeah. I mean, that's a lifetime practice.
Mm-hmm.
What is it that comes forth from my own breast?
Yeah.
You know,
that's what it's all about.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so if there's even just one line from one story that can help liberate any of us, then that's the benefit, I think, of this approach.
Yeah, turning words. In Zen, we say, well, can you give me a turning word? Sometimes just a word that turns us around so where suddenly Buddha nature stands in front of us and yanks us out of the rut. Any final sesshin comments or things to bring up? Often I'm struck by, it's a funny thing we do. It's, you know, it's not for everyone. It's totally open to everyone, but it's all about condition. The conditions are not ripe for some people to end up in such a weird situation as a room like this. So, for those who do, I think then there's this great feeling of intimacy, like, wow, there's like you're reading a story like this and like, you know, then other people like could possibly be even slightly open to this kind of thing is actually amazing. So that's and other people will connect with the light in so many different ways, but how great to share this particular house wind. Thank you, Kazan, Zenji, and see, where were we? Qingyuan, Shirto, Yaoshan, and Yunyan. Those four great ancestors that we got to know a little bit this week. Or whatever. I don't know what day it is. dedicate any merit arising from this Denko, a light transmitting assembly, to the free circulation of the light through all beings. May they be free, at ease, in joy in the midst of their lives. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.